Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. If we assume that the growth of the sport continues, which I think we all hope and expect it to, then I think we could see these valuations going up, maybe even 50% more than they are now.
Exactly. Yeah, we might see the first $10 billion Formula One team. Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport, and a happy new year to all our listeners around the world. It's the first week of January. The slate has been wiped clean. A whole new year of F1 lies ahead of us. And at this magical stage, full of possibility, all the teams and drivers are equal. Well, in theory at least. But before a car is launched and a wheel is turned, we always like to look ahead to the new season and do a little bit of what we call super forecasting. We did it last year, and some of the forecasts were pretty accurate, while others have not aged all that well. But to help us today, we have a couple of real subject matter experts. Former Aston Martin technical director and Red Bull head of aerodynamics and a friend of the pod, Dan Fallows. Happy New Year to you, Dan.
Happy New Year, James. It's great to be back again on your estimable podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And our F1 writer attending races all over the world, Ronald Vording. Gelukkig Nieuwjaar. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, exactly. Gelukkig Nieuwjaar, yeah. Although I have to say, I haven't been in the Netherlands for a long time because of all the F1 travel. So probably your Dutch is just as good as mine by now.
Good. I'm sure I'll try and seek to take advantage of that somewhere along the line. Anyway, let's start with a couple of gentle ones just to get us all warmed up, shall we? Who's going to win the 2026 F1 Drivers' World Championship? Ronald, why don't you start?
Yeah, gentle one. I would say it's probably the $1 million question and probably the most difficult one. Because usually you could just look at the year before and see some trend lines and give an educated guess. This year, it's, as you said, completely new set of regulations, everything new. But my line of thinking would be that I think Mercedes will have a competitive power unit. That goes back to a chat, a funny chat we had with Toto Wolff in Zandvoort, the Dutch media session that we talked about before in the podcast, where Toto said there's a lot of AI pictures, but even some 18 plus AI videos of myself circulating online. So that felt like an evening in the pub. But we also talked about 26 and how confident he is in the Mercedes power unit. And he sounded really confident, but then he said, even if we have the best engine, we still need to beat our customer teams, including, of course, McLaren. So for me, I'm hugely in doubt between picking one of the Mercedes drivers or go for McLaren. But looking at the strength and depth in the McLaren technical department and all the massive, I know completely different regulations, but the massive steps they made in the last 2 or 3 years, I don't really want to bet against McLaren. And if I don't want to bet against McLaren, then maybe the obvious choice would be Lando, but I'm going to pick Oscar because you have to zoom out a little bit. And if you look at 2025 and forget about his form dip that started in Baku and then continued in Austin and Mexico, but if we just zoom out, he made massive steps compared to Lando compared to the year before. And that's kind of the trajectory that he has shown, not only in Formula One, but in his career even before that. So if he can make, and it doesn't even need to be such a big step again, but if he can make another step, then this year might be Oscar's year. So yeah, I'll go for Oscar Piastri.
Well, that all sounds extremely well thought through, Ronald. Dan, would you go along with that, or do you see a different outcome?
No, I'm following the logic. I think that's that makes an awful lot of sense. I think Ronald's hit a lot of the key points there. I think particularly with the Mercedes power unit, that's good. I would have thought that from everything we hear. Well, of course, we have to take that a little bit with a pinch of salt. But I think based on previous history as well, there's a lot to like about where they'll be, I think, at the beginning of the season. I think Mercedes as a team, I've thought this for a while, they're feeling like a team that's been scorned a little bit. They've not had the results that they wanted to over the last few years. And even, coming a solid second in the championship, I think they, they all looked as though they'd been sort of defeated, and that was really not what they wanted to be. So I think they're putting a huge amount of effort into this year. I think they will hit the ground running and probably have a very, very strong car from the outset. I think we could talk up the fact that they are, you know, very closely linked to their own power unit manufacturer, but I think it's inevitable that there is some benefit to having that closer link with the power unit manufacturer to start off with. I mean, I'm sure McLaren will have all of the tools at their disposal, but there's no doubt that Mercedes will have some kind of advantage, it being a kind of in-house effort. And I think that'll play out most strongly at the beginning of the rule set. So I think they're going to be the car to beat. I just can't see that anybody's going to be able to get there, provided their power unit is as good as everybody expects it to be. That being the case, then I think it's been fascinating to see how Kimi Antonelli's getting on, how he's getting better through the last season. But for me, George Russell is an extremely strong driver, and I think given a championship chance, he'll grab it with both hands. So he's my bet.
No, that's really interesting as well. So thank you to both of you for that. I have to say they're both very compelling arguments, and ones that I've kind of made to myself while sort of thinking about this and thinking about these questions. I did come to the conclusion in the second half of last season, I agree with you, Dan, that George Russell does have what it takes to be a world champion if you give him a championship capable package. And I think the fact that he's got a teammate who's still going to be only 19 years old during the course of next season and still got clearly a heck of a lot to learn would be an advantage to him in a sort of head-to-head against the two McLaren drivers for a driver's championship. So I agree with your logic, Ronald, that Piastri still has more growth, and I think he will go away and be a stronger competitor in 26 for where he failed in 25. I think the fact that he's got Lando in the other car and they will continue to take points off each other, which almost opened the door to Verstappen this year with the car that Verstappen had. So I think the logic there, I'm going with you, Dan. I think I think Russell is a world champion if you give him the car. Does that mean we rule out Red Bull and Ferrari? What was interesting listening to our Super Forecasting podcast from this time last year was how bullish everybody was about Ferrari. They'd finished the season strongly. They only narrowly missed out on winning the Constructors the year before, and yet they were in nowheresville, weren't they, Dan? So what about the Constructors' Championship? Do you see Mercedes doing it? Do you see McLaren doing it? And perhaps give us your thoughts on your old team, Red Bull, and also Ferrari.
Well, I think for the Constructors' point of view, you have to have two drivers scoring points regularly and making sure that they're not crashing into each other and all the things that have stopped that happening in the past. But I think you look at the top teams now, they do have strong driver pairings, with the possible exception of Red Bull. And I say that simply because I think, you know, Isaac Hadjar is a slightly unproven talent. I mean, he's definitely a talent, but he's slightly unproven in that seat. And as we know, that can be a little bit of a poison chalice if the history repeats itself within this regulation set. So if you look at the sort of top teams as they were, the Mercedes and McLaren, they've definitely got very strong driver pairings. And in Ferrari, I think, you know, although Lewis Hamilton's had a tough season by his own admission, we know what he's capable of. And if Ferrari put a package together, that could be strong. I think really they're the biggest unknown for me. I mean, Ferrari, we just have no idea where they're going to come out. And I think genuinely, if they did become genuine Constructors Championship contenders, it would be a pleasant surprise. But I think we have to admit it probably would be a surprise. It's not on the run of form. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to go into a new regulation set anyway. So I'm not going to change my opinion from Mercedes being the strongest contenders with the Constructors as well, although that's possibly a more boring answer than you'd like.
Ronald, what can you do for us?
Well, similar thoughts. I will again go for Mercedes and McLaren. I think two things to pick up on. Well, first, going back to the Toto roundtable, it was funny because, of course, he mentioned the customer teams, and then he also mentioned Ferrari, he also mentioned Aston Martin. And then we said, well, you forgot one. You didn't mention Red Bull, and you didn't mention Red Bull powertrains. And he said, apologies for the language, but he said, oh yeah, they are going to be shit, which of course was a joke. But he was joking that at least they have the Mount Everest to climb. And I think that's a fair assessment. But with Mercedes, I would say they have two potential advantages. The first one is the one that Dan touched upon earlier. I think that's an important one. They are a factory team, so in terms of packaging, they probably have an advantage over McLaren. The second one is, yes, they didn't get it right with the ground effect cars, but Toto was quite open about it and said, yeah, we never like fully understood the dynamics of these regulations as much as we wanted. And the regulations for 26 are completely different and not so much dependent on the ground effect anymore. So maybe it suits them a little bit better. So that's why even in the first answer, it was almost impossible for me to guess between or to pick between Mercedes and McLaren. But if you guys stick with Mercedes, then I guess I have to stick with McLaren now, so there's no way back. And they have a really strong driver lineup. Yes, sometimes they take points off each other, but I think with the papaya rules, we've talked a lot about papaya rules on the podcast, but we have to give them some credit because it has prevented them from crashing into each other. And if they can do the same in 2026, then they still have a really good lineup. They still have a great technical team. They still have the Mercedes power unit, so let's go for three in a row then with McLaren.
Interesting. Before we move on, actually, Dan, because you're obviously an expert on this, you know, as a head of aero and what have you, people got it wrong with those ground effect rules, and Red Bull got it very right, your old team. So do we think with the 26 rules that there will be teams that will get it wrong, or is it fundamentally just a more straightforward thing that all of them are at a high enough level now that no one's going to really drop the ball?
I think that's a really good point to highlight. I think that a lot of the talk will be around the power units because it's possibly the biggest change, although aerodynamically it is fairly different as well. But I think, you know, the power units will probably be the biggest differentiator in terms of performance across the grid. I think that's... And there's lots of different aspects to that. There's not just the power they generate, but also the energy management and all these other things as well. So that will be a big talking point. But it's right not to forget that the aerodynamics are fundamentally different. And I think there will be differing opinions about how to get it to work. I mean, without spending the whole podcast talking about it, because it's my specialist subject and I'd always talk about aerodynamics until the cows come home. But the purpose of these regulations is really to sort of take the wake from the front wheels and create as much havoc with the rear of the car as possible. With the result, you can then manage that wake and keep it away from the following car. That causes, you know, a number of problems for aerodynamicists. And the additional problem they have this time is that they have these floorboards, it's a barge boards that are on the extremity of the front of the floor, which are actually directing the air, the wake from the tyres even further inboard and making it even harder to control. And I think we'll see a diverging range of solutions to that problem. There'll be people who sort of, you know, embrace that and try and sort of carry on and fire it as far inboard as possible. And there'll be people who do something different. And that whole front of floor treatment will be very interesting. And there will be people who've simply gone down in inverted commas the wrong direction. And there'll be a correction, I guess, mid-season or whenever they realize that isn't the most sort of performant or going to give them the most options. So it will be fascinating to see whether we actually understand what's going on there or whether it'll be all drowned out by the power unit discussions. It's difficult to say, but I think we may see some teams changing direction fairly on in the season.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we mustn't forget that when we saw that last rule change, we had this porpoising effect, the cars bouncing up and down, and it was all a bit comical, really. It wasn't really very F1, so hopefully we won't see too much of that. Well, let's go a little deeper now. We expect a pretty active driver market, don't we, Ronald, at the end of this 2026 season. So a number of drivers will be looking around to see who's got the best package and obviously trying to get themselves into it for 2027. So I'll put it to you then, Ronald, what's going to be the most high-profile driver move from the end of this year into next year?
Also an interesting one. First, to come back to what Dan said, because the FIA fully agrees with that prediction, by the way. The FIA also thinks that the engine will be the biggest performance differentiator in 26. And they also expect to see convergence aerodynamically like midway through the season, exactly what we have seen in 2022, of course, with the three different side pod solutions that we saw with downwash, inwash, and zero pod, and it all converged gradually. Then to come back to driver market, I think it will probably be a repeat of last year. And that means that the whole soap series surrounding Max Verstappen will probably start again. It goes back to something, I can't remember if it was Mexico or Austin, but Toto Wolff was in the press conference. And of course, they announced the 2026 lineup, but also left the door open for Max in 27. So I asked Toto, I said, well, how complicated has it been for you behind the scenes? Because of course, you want to be loyal to your current drivers, but also you want to keep the door open for Max. And then I added, do we get the same all over again in like 7 or 8 months from now? And then he started laughing and said, I knew you were going to ask it, but it's only October and we're already talking about it now. But I think it's inevitable if Red Bull is not competitive from the get-go that speculation will start again. I think it's also a sensible thing from Max's perspective. First waiting 1 year, so waiting for 26 to see who is competitive and who is not. Because of course, we talk a lot about Mercedes, but the same can be said about Aston Martin with all the developments there. Of course, new factory, all the hirings they have. Honda, Max has a great relationship with Honda as well. So for me, two big questions. The first one is how competitive will Red Bull be from the get-go? And if the answer is not so competitive, then I think Max Verstappen is again in the focus of all attention and it will be him basically kickstarting the silly season. And then I would not be surprised if he moves to either Mercedes or Aston. And if he does, then of course that will have a knock-on effect for the rest of the driver market, because if he does go to Mercedes, I should say, and if Fernando Alonso quits, we will talk about that in a second, I guess, then the one that has to go at Mercedes will be probably a good option at Aston. So I think Max again holds the key and then the others will follow. One move, probably regardless of what Max will do, that I predict for 27 is that Oliver Bearman will probably end up in a Ferrari. So for me, it's Max holds the key for the silly season for 90% of it, and then the other 10% might be Oliver Bearman getting the step up to Ferrari in 2027.
Presumably meaning that Lewis Hamilton will retire at the end of the year.
I don't want to give away the answer for one of the other questions, but indeed, that's another prediction, yes.
Well, we'll take them together. So but what about you, Dan? I mean, which drivers do you think might leave the sport at the end of 26? And what do you think the most high-profile driver swap could be?
You've kind of spoiled my answer really there, Ronald, because I was going to go for Lewis Hamilton as being the sort of key to the driver market. I think it's sort of easy to put him in the same bracket as Fernando Alonso in that, you know, somebody who's clearly still very, very capable, although he did struggle a bit last year. I think somebody who can definitely turn in the performances when he needs to. The question for me really is, has he got the same desire? Has he got the same, you know, will to carry on as long as he possibly can? If he's not in a 100% competitive car, whereas Fernando is, you know, driving other cars, doing, you know, still very keen. He's got his own karting circuit and so on. I'm not sure Lewis is that committed to racing as a whole. I mean, that might be a horrible slight on the man. He's extremely committed to Formula One. There's no doubt about that. But I think I don't see him as somebody who would necessarily want to carry on just because he loves it. I think he wants to be competitive. I think he wants to be in a car that's capable of getting in those race wins. So if he does retire, I think he'll probably say it quite early on, give Ferrari a chance to bring in a new driver. And I think that will trigger a lot of moves. Ollie Bearman is an obvious person to take that place, but you know there may be others. And at the same time, if Ferrari doesn't have a competitive car, does Charles Leclerc want to stay there? I mean, does he want to maybe look at other options? I think the whole question about Max Verstappen is a very interesting one, and there's no doubt that there will be a lot of talk about that at the beginning of the season if Red Bull aren't where they want to be. I suppose the point you should make about Red Bull is that they are an absolute development machine. And if they're not competitive at the start of the season, we know now that there are mechanisms by which the FIA can improve the power unit performance through the year, or can allow them to improve the power unit performance through the year. I know that, you know, as an aerodynamics department and as a technical department, they are more than capable of putting a huge amount of performance on a car in a fairly short space of time. So it could be that they are maybe not looking competitive to start off with, but then they're on an incredible journey, and that could be quite attractive for other drivers.
I think Charles is actually a really interesting bit in this whole conversation, because if Fernando quits and if Lewis quits, then the situations at Aston and Ferrari are, in my opinion, completely different, but only if Charles will stay. Because if Charles stays, then Ferrari has let's say, a lead driver that they can fully trust long term, and they can bring in a young talent. Whereas Aston is a completely different situation, of course, because they've always gone for a big signing. They've done that with Sebastian Vettel. They've done it with Fernando Alonso after it. And if Fernando quits, I think the next one on the list of Lawrence Stroll is probably Max Verstappen. So I think if Fernando and Lewis both retire at the end of 26, then the questions that the teams have to answer, so Aston and Ferrari, are completely different. But only if Charles Leclerc stays, because if he leaves, then Ferrari has a lot more questions to answer, and then it will be really, really entertaining to see what's going to happen for 27.
Well, you've led us on very nicely to what I think will be one of the really interesting talking points going into this season, and certainly the first half of the season, which is, you know, you were saying, Dan, that Ferrari is a big unknown this year, but Aston Martin surely as well is a very big unknown. You're another one of your old teams. First of all, they're changing their engines. They're going to be the only Honda-powered team. So Honda, one would expect, should produce a pretty tasty engine, given the thing that, they've been very competitive for the last few years, and you know, they know what they're doing with these kind of engines. Then your old colleague, Adrian Newey, has been there for, about 10 months now, and his fingerprints will be all over this car for 2026, and they've invested enormously in facilities and all the rest of it. They're a real unknown. Surprisingly, they finished seventh in the Constructors' Championship last year with only 89 points. But where do we think that they're going to end up in 2026, Dan?
I think, you know, I'm obviously highly biased here, so you might have to take what I say with a pinch of salt. But it is a team which is on a journey and making, you know, quite impressive progress. I think the sort of move to Honda engines was a coup for them, because it is a works team. Now, whether the Honda power unit will be where it needs to be to start off with is a moot point. But again, we've seen that Honda can develop. You know, they put a huge amount of resource into it. I mean, that was obvious right from the outset of that initiation of that project with Honda. They put an enormous amount of resource and effort into it. And I think even if they're not where they need to be, they will get there in fairly short order. But it is a growth phase for the team, and I think we shouldn't forget that. You know, even though Adrian joining is a big coup for them, it marks a big sort of step in their development. It is a process, and it does take time. And they've gone from something, you know, when I joined, which was a fairly small team in a small factory, to something which is much more like the size that you need to be. But it takes a long time for these things to bed in. It takes time for the various departments to work together in the correct way. I mean, all these things we hear about, and they're fairly cliches, but it is true, and it does take time. And I think, you know, Adrian would be the first person to admit that you can't go from zero to absolutely championship contenders in no time at all. So I think the really key thing for them is to see that they're continuing that journey in the right way. And as you pointed out, I don't think they'll believe that seventh in the championship is representative of where they want to be. But equally, they have decided clearly to make to almost sort of sacrifice last year to make sure that they had the best opportunity to show that they're making that progress this year. I don't think anybody inside the team, who knows, because I'm not there anymore, but I don't think anybody inside the team will expect them to be championship contenders from the outset. But you know, I've worked with Adrian before. He's capable of pulling out surprises. So who knows? But I think, you know, really, if we see some good progress from them as a team, they will be pleased with that this year.
So a move forward from seventh in the constructors. Well, Ronald, another team with a lot of focus on it will be Williams. They said a year ago that they were going to pretty much sacrifice 2025 to throw all their efforts at 2026 and these new rules. And yet they turned out a pretty decent car. Might not have developed it all that much as the year went on, but they still managed to end up in fifth place in the Constructors' Championship, which was an enormous achievement given their stated aim for the year was. Do you think they're capable of improving on that in 2026?
Well, I think first we should say that maybe the fifth place in 2025 was better than expected, also better than expected within the team. I think James Fowles explained many times, and rightfully so, that it's a long-term project. And of course, as Dan said, that's true for every team on the grid, but even more for Williams, if you look at their facilities and the catch-up work that they had to do. And he said multiple times, I basically have to catch up for 20 or 30 years if you look at the state of the facilities and the factory. And that's, of course, not fixed overnight. So it's still the same challenge in a way. So I think I can echo what Dan said, that it's a long-term project. Yes, they're on the right trajectory for sure, but it will take a lot of time. You can only maybe shortcut it with a reset of regulations if you find something that the others didn't, but then I would probably put more money on Adrian Newey finding something that the others didn't instead of Williams. So yeah, I think it's just a continued progress. The good thing for them is, besides having that Mercedes power unit, they have stability on all fronts now. They have stability with the leadership. They have stability with the drivers. They have two really good drivers, and also maybe even more important, two really good drivers in terms of technical feedback. Whenever I speak to Carlos, I find his, even if you talk to the media, some drivers don't really care, but Carlos always tries to give you a good answer, and the level of detail he gives compared to some of the others always impresses me. So I think on all fronts they have the right ingredients. It will just take time to bring back Williams where they belong. But I mean, the fifth place from last year, I think if they can do the same in 2026, that would already be a quite successful season for them, to be honest.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because moving forward from fifth means you've got to beat one of McLaren, Mercedes, yeah, Red Bull or Ferrari. And given, as Dan was saying earlier on, the strength of the driver lineups there, it's unless Ferrari have another year like last year, in which case potentially a stronger Williams might just finish in front of them. That's possibly true. They've got two very, very good drivers, although Albon's second half of the year was a little bit disappointing compared to Sainz, so he'll have to raise his game, won't he? But it's an interesting position they've put themselves in, Williams, because they kind of overperformed in 25 and have given themselves a challenge to be able to show demonstrable progress in 2026.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at Menards.
Well, what about F1's two new manufacturer names then? Audi and Cadillac. Audi, as we all know, is Sauber rebadged with the Audi engine making its Formula One debut, which is a big question mark. Meanwhile, Cadillac is an all-new team, but with a Ferrari engine and a lot of customer parts that they're allowed to use at the back of the car. Dan, who comes out on top between these two?
There's a short answer to that, which is, I think, is Audi for me. As you say, it's an unknown about their power unit, as it is with, frankly, with all of them. But we really don't know where they are with that. But equally, you could say the same thing about Ferrari. So I don't. If you sort of put those to one side for a second, just in terms of the capabilities of the team. Now, it's not to say that Cadillac haven't done a good job in the short time that they've been working on these regulations and working themselves towards Formula One. But it's a mammoth undertaking to put a team onto the grid these days. It's the technical teams themselves are hundreds of people. There are lots of different departments with the simulation side of things and tools and technologies that have to be done, and just to try to even just get those into the state where you can put a reasonable car together is a huge undertaking. And frankly, Audi are far further ahead on that. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the talent that they've got there. They've got some good names there, some good people who've been around for a while. They understand how to make the most out of rule changes as well. And I think they should be able to put a decent contender together. And actually, when you look at their results over last season as well, I think they're on a trajectory. There's some momentum there. They're starting to believe in themselves as a team, which they haven't had before. Jonathan Wheatley's brought a sort of new energy there, as Mattia Binotto has as well, and I think they will be quite a good contender for the midfield if they get a decent power unit, and I think they would probably see that as a good as a, you know, something good to aim for is that sort of fifth, sixth place in the championship. That would be a massive thing for them. For Cadillac, I just don't think they're looking in the, at the same thing. I think they're looking to make sure that they, you know, they make a good account of themselves and they, you know, start to build this project with some good credibility this year. I think that's that would be a really good thing for them.
Yeah, and I think maybe probably two things to add, because the same thing is also true on the driver's front. I think if you look at Audi, they've got a brilliant lineup, not only for 26, but probably even for the years beyond. They have one experienced driver, but still one that's incredibly quick, like quick over one lap. Okay, he's had some qualifying difficulties in 2025, but he bounced back from those. And one driver that can capitalize if opportunities come up. Look at Silverstone and the podium that he got, also based on experience. And then on the other side of the garage, they have Bortoleto, who I rate really highly, and he will become better and better and better. And if you compare that to Cadillac, it's a different story. I mean, of course, Checo and Valtteri, both excellent drivers, but I'm not sure, to say it in a really polite way, if they're still at their absolute peak in terms of pure speed. But that's fine, because as Dan said, if you build a project like Cadillac, you're looking for different things. You're looking for experience. You're looking for good technical feedback from the drivers. Even those drivers have a lot of contacts in the paddock that might help to build the project even further. So I think that's just more, you know, long-term different stages of both projects. And the same can be said about if you look at correlation and things like that, because I've had a couple of talks about that when it was still Sauber. Then probably that was the biggest gain of the end of 24 and also of 25, that the things they saw in their wind tunnel and the simulations actually proved to be correct on track, whereas that was not always the case in the two seasons before that. So even though you've got completely new regulations, that still gives you some confidence no matter what the regulations are. And for Cadillac, that's basically all a lot of unknowns compared to the Audi project. So yeah, I would definitely, for both the drivers and also the state of the project, go for Audi.
You make some interesting points. I think with Cadillac, the thing when I was looking at that choice they made to go for the two experienced drivers, as you say, putting it politely, there's a question mark about whether either of them is still at their peak when it comes to speed. And the thing is that if you're not getting the results in a sports environment, it can be very difficult to maintain your sort of ultra performance mindset and your motivation. So I think one of the things I'd love to know, Dan, is, I mean, it always seems to me that if you're running a Formula One team, wherever you are on the grid, you really need to have one driver in the car who you know is going to extend that car and do the absolute best lap time that car is capable of, because then you know where you are, don't you, as a benchmark. And would you be a little concerned if you had two drivers who, you know, you're not sure if you're necessarily getting the absolute fastest lap time? I mean, one could also ask the same question, I suppose, about Aston Martin. But would that be an issue for you, not being 100% sure if you're getting the absolute fastest lap time out of the car?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point that Ronald made as well. I think you do want that feedback, and I think having two experienced drivers in the car, like Sergio and Valtteri, they are incredibly experienced, and they know exactly what it is that their engineering teams are looking to hear. You know, they know what feedback they need to give, and it's a shortcut to understanding the car. So if you're a new team and you're looking to build, and you're looking to make sure that you push your development teams in the right direction, then what you need to have is a very clear understanding of where the car, what you need to do to the car to make it go faster. Which seems like a simple thing, but it's sometimes the drivers that can extract the most lap time from the car. Firstly, they may not be able to do that all the time. There may be some circumstances where if you give them a car which is slightly trickier to drive, they may not be able to extract the most from it. So yes, they can get the right lap time out of the right car, but maybe if it's a little bit of a handful, they struggle a bit more with that. And sometimes you'd actually take somebody, you know, ironically, you'd take somebody who's more consistent rather than somebody who has that sort of outright pace. So what you get from a more experienced driver is absolutely consistency, and you get really good feedback. And actually, when you think about the sort of lap times, it's very unusual that you get, particularly in testing of a new car, it's very unusual that you get a very good understanding of exactly where your absolute lap time is relative to everybody else. We've seen that recently in the last few years. It's actually quite frustrating as an engineering team, because sometimes you come out of testing and you think everybody straps on the softest tire on the last day, and you know, here we go, we're going to find out where everybody is. And actually people haven't done that, or you've, you know, there's been a fuel level differences or all of these different things, and you never really know. Usually the best indication you have of where your car is normally on the kind of long run pace. And for that, you need a driver who can just bang in the lap times. And then you know that as the tyres degrade, you're getting a very good, accurate read on the tyre degradation. You're understanding how the car performs in different fuel levels, all these different things. That's what you get from an experienced driver. So particularly when you're at the early stages of a project or at the early stages of a car, having two very experienced drivers is, I would say, is a very clever strategic move, actually, and particularly for that team.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, let's have a bit of fun now then. And this will work because it's irrelevant how competitive the car is. This is just purely about driver performance. So let's look, for example, start with Red Bull Racing. We talked already about the fact that they're going to be using engines designed and built at their own Milton Keynes factory, with Ford badging on that and some technical support from Ford. But the whole package is a real unknown, as we've said. What is known is Max Verstappen's brilliance. He clearly demonstrated that last season. And his new teammate, Isaac Hadjar, was the rookie of the year in my book for the drives and the performances he put in, including a podium finish in the Racing Bulls car. And so that got him the promotion to the top team at the expense of Yuki Tsunoda, who's now sitting on the sidelines of F1. Now, for a lot of people, as Dan said earlier on, driving that second Red Bull car has been a bit of a poison chalice. So my question is, what percentage of Verstappen's point total will Hadjar achieve? So it's irrelevant how competitive the car is. This is just down to how they perform relative to each other. For reference, Tsunoda last year, I think, was on about 10%, something like that, of Verstappen's points. Perez in 2024 got 34%, and in 2023 he got 49%. So what do we think Hadjar will do this year relative to Verstappen? Ronald, why don't you have a stab at that?
I think if he gets to the 34 that Checo had in 2024, it would already be quite okay. I know that he will definitely not settle for it himself, because I remember all the media sessions I had with him last year, especially when we talked about all those Red Bull rumors. And there's one moment that comes to my mind. I think it was Monza, when we talked about the chance for 26 and the reset in regulations. And I said, okay, do you think that with a reset that it will be easier? And he sat back a little and said, much easier. Yeah, a lot easier, because all the issues with the second Red Bull car that we talk about, they will all be gone. They don't exist anymore. And I was like, well, okay, that sounds pretty confident. Maybe a bit too confident. I don't know. I mean, going there, you need the confidence. But I say maybe having a car that's hopefully for them a bit more predictable is one thing. But you still, and that's the other thing, you still have Max Verstappen and the other side of the garage. And if you look at the data and if you come back after a run and you think, oh, I've done a pretty good lap here, and you're still like 4 or 5 tenths down, then you have to stay calm also mentally. And I think that will be a big challenge for him. So I think a lot depends on his mindset. He shouldn't go there. And that's what Helmut Marko, okay, he's gone now, but that's what Helmut Marko already told him multiple times. He said, you should not go there with the mentality to become world champion immediately. And that it doesn't relate to what Checo again said this week, that, oh, it's going to be a problem if I'm quicker than Max. Not at all. But it relates to just focus on your own thing and not trying to beat Max Verstappen straight away, because I think that's where a lot of Max's teammates have gone wrong in the past. But if he keeps his calm and if he gets, let's say, close to 40 or 50% of Max's points, I think that would be quite an okay year for him to start his Red Bull career.
What do you reckon, Dan? I mean, what, you know, probably best driver in the world, one of the greatest of all time, at the peak of his powers in one car. What does a second year rookie with clearly talent, raw speed, what does a good points percentage look like? Somewhere around a third, or would you be expecting a bit more?
So I'm coming at this from a slightly more mathematical side. So if you think about the way the points are divvied out, then if you are in the contention for the sort of top spots on the grid, or you're going to come first or second, then clearly you're gaining the most points by quite a long way. If your car is sort of down in the bottom end of the point scoring, then if you both come quite close to each other or a couple of places apart, you're going to get a similar number of points. So I think, although I think Max is undoubtedly you know, going to be a quicker driver. It's not to say there's anything wrong with Isaac. I think I agree with you. I think he was, in many ways, driver of the season last year. He'd be a very, very interesting talent for the future. I think, you know, Max is clearly an extraordinary driver at the peak of his powers, really. But if that car is not going to be as competitive as some of the other Mercedes, perhaps Mercedes-powered cars, then, you know, maybe they're looking at further down the points, so his percentage could be higher. Now, that's probably an engineer's answer to it, but I'm going to go slightly higher. I'll say something more like 50% of the points that Max will get. I think if he did come within a couple of positions in races, you know, qualifying within a couple of spots of Max, I think he would see that as a job well done.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's entirely dependent exactly on how high up in the points rankings they're finishing. What about Lewis Hamilton and Charles Leclerc? I don't think anybody had on their bingo card last year that Hamilton would score 64% of the points of Leclerc. I think a lot of people thought that they'd be pretty close and maybe Hamilton might edge it given his pedigree. But it's not the way it worked out. 64% only of Leclerc's points. Ronald, what are you going for in 2026? Who's going to be the top dog out of the two of them, and what's the percentage going to be?
Well, I still think it's going to be Leclerc, which would be the obvious choice after last year. But having said that, a lot depends on how they will adapt their driving style to the new regulations. Because even sitting here, we don't know how different Formula One will be. But even from conversations I had with Nicolas Tombazos at the FIA, it's pretty clear that F1 will be different, and not just from a fan's perspective, but also from a driver's perspective. It will be a lot more of a energy management race in a way. Maybe also requires a different driving style, especially compared to the ground effect cars. So it's really difficult to say, does that suit Lewis Hamilton, his driving style? And if not, how quickly can someone adapt? Because from the talks I had with Max, he always says, I don't have a driving style. I'm not sure if that's true, but he says, I don't have a driving style. I just adapt to whatever is required. But I think that will be a key factor in 2026, and not just for Ferrari, but for everyone on the grid. And I think if we talk about Ferrari and if we talk about Lewis, I think that will probably be a crucial factor, not just in the percentage, but also in his long-term future. Does he like the regulations? Does it suit his driving style, or can he make it work? And related to that, does he want to stay in F1 beyond 2026? So I think that's the key factor. That's a factor that's impossible to predict right now before winter testing. But if I have to give you a number, I would at least hope that he does better than last year. So I still expect Charles to be the main man there. But if Lewis got 64, it was, I guess, last year, you said, then let's hope he at least gets more than 80 this season.
How about you, Dan? What do you think?
I'm gonna back Lewis a bit more than that. I think he obviously found the transition to Ferrari very difficult in a difficult rule season with a car that's clearly quite tricky to drive. But you know, and his we could easily question his mental resilience based on last year in terms of, you know, he was clearly frustrated. And, you know, there were conversations with engineers and things. And it felt like a sort of chink in the armor. But I think you don't win that many championships without having, you know, incredible reserves of resilience and determination. And I think if he starts the season with a car that he can understand and he can set up to his liking. And I think with these regulations that we come, you know, these cars should be a lot easier to get into some kind of window. You know, they'll still have to be optimized, but I think they're going to be easier dynamically for the drivers to get on top of. And if it comes down to giving a driver a car which he can understand, you know, is predictable to an extent, and he just needs to wring the best lap time out of it, then I still think, you know, Lewis Hamilton is right up there, and it will be interesting to see if he does get close to Charles on a few occasions, you know, how would that work? You know, because I think he maybe has become a bit comfortable with being the number one driver at Ferrari now. And if Lewis really starts to show his form again, how would that affect Charles? So I think it could be pretty even. I'm going to boldly predict that Lewis will get very similar number of points to Charles next or this season.
Yeah, I think I'm slightly more on your side as well. I think I would go for about 80%. I think, and if he doesn't, then I think this will certainly be his last year in Formula One. It might be anyway, but only time will tell. And finally then, Kimi Antonelli and George Russell. Antonelli last year got 47% of Russell's points. We said at the top of this podcast that we see Russell as a potential world champion this year. Do we see Antonelli getting a better percentage, Ronald, than 47?
Yeah, I think so, especially because he struggled massively in the European part of the 2025 season. And that was, of course, linked to the Mercedes suspension. I think it was Qatar or Abu Dhabi, where both he and also Schöffelin admitted that basically Antonelli lost 2 or 3 months of his progress, which was, of course, linked to confidence to a big extent. So I think already in 25, the percentage should have been a bit higher than that. If you look at what he did in the flyaways, especially the back end of the season, it's really impressive. So I would expect him to follow the same path. Still expect George, of course, to be the main driver at Mercedes, as both of you said at the beginning. He's incredibly quick, incredibly consistent, and also mature when the pressure is really on him. So that's everything you need basically to fight for a world title. So yes, George is probably still the man to beat within that team, but I would definitely, or let's put it the other way around, I would be extremely surprised if Antonelli is still on only less than 50% of George's points at the end of 26. So I expect that to be considerably higher.
Staying with you, Ronald, for a slightly contentious question. 2025 was a dramatic year for team boss replacements. It became a bit more like football than Formula One, with the people at the top of the organisation either being sacked or resigning. Christian Horner was dropped by Red Bull in the summer, Andy Cowell by Aston Martin towards the end of the year. And we mustn't forget that Alpine started the season with Oliver Oakes as the team principal. He resigned in May. So my question to you, Ronald, is which F1 team boss or bosses will not still be in post 12 months from now? A tricky one for you. Go on.
It is. But I think there are two scenarios to replace your team principal. The first one is, of course, if the results are not there, which ultimately was the reason that Red Bull communicated to us. We all know there was a lot more going on behind the scenes, but still results played a role. So that's the first part of it. And then if we go back to the beginning of the podcast, then a lot of pressure is on Ferrari. I really hope they come up with a competitive car. But if they don't, and then we all know the politics going on in Maranello, that might be a difficult position to retain, especially given all the rumors in the Italian media. I know Fred hated it, but it was still the reality that in Italy, a lot of rumors started already about his position in 25. And then, of course, that made no sense at all because Ferrari, they have been really clear and open in saying, okay, we stopped developing this year's car in April. Everything will be on 26. But that means that the pressure on 26 is huge. So that has to be delivered in 26 by the team. So I think Ferrari, there's a lot of pressure there. The other scenario is just by bringing in someone else. And I'm still, in that regard, not fully convinced what Aston Martin wants to do. Because yes, Adrian Newey is now the team principal. But I can't really see him taking on all the responsibilities, including all the endless media talks and answering all our stupid questions and stuff like that. So I'm still surprised if he will be the only one to hold that position, or if they bring in someone like Giampiero Lambiase or someone else in a more senior role. So also I will keep an eye out on Aston Martin, and along similar lines, I will do the same with Alpine. Because yes, we've got Flavio, and we all know Flavio is the big man in charge there. But also there, we know they have had conversations and still have with Christian Horner. So do they want to bring him in? And if so, in what kind of role and position? So I would definitely look at Ferrari, but that's because of the pressure. And then Aston and Alpine, because of maybe some good options might show up along the way.
Okay, very good. I won't put that question to you, Dan, because I know you've got a lot of friendships up and down the pit lane. You don't need to compromise. Just moving then, finally, before we wrap this up, to the business side of the sport. We saw Toto Wolff selling a small stake in Mercedes F1 team that valued it at over $6 billion. Still some way off the highest valuations of NFL teams like the Dallas Cowboys, which I think are now up around $11 or $12 billion valuation, but comparable with top Premier League football teams and Barcelona FC, for example, was Mercedes. I think it was quite surprising for a lot of people. That's the highest quoted figure for an F1 team to date. McLaren did a share sale a few months earlier that valued the business at around $4.5 billion. So my question to you is, what do we think the top teams will be valued at in 12 months' time? Any thoughts on that, Dan?
I mean, I'm fascinated by how these valuations are arrived at, because obviously they're only realized when there's some kind of liquidation event, or there has to be some kind of liquidity, otherwise these teams don't get valued because they're not public companies, with one exception. So it's fascinating why they are deriving so much value from them when ostensibly the revenue generation is not really that different. So you have to imagine that this pricing is because of future value of the teams, and then it's the types of investors who are coming into these teams. We're seeing sort of increasing investment by private equity firms, for example. They're clearly in this because they will have some kind of exit strategy. So they see that there is a future value of these teams which is going to go up. So whilst it seems extraordinary that teams are worth this much now, $6 billion or so on, I would imagine because of the interest of the private equity groups we've seen, it's going to go much higher than that. And I think it depends a lot on seeing a continued growth in the sport. We need to see increasing viewing figures, but after the success of the F1 movie and all the other things around F1, I would imagine that will continue. We could, I suppose, based on our previous conversations, say it kind of depends a little bit on the success of these regulations, because if it turns out that this doesn't produce as good racing as we've enjoyed over the last couple of years, then viewing figures could be hurt by that, and that will, I would imagine, quite quickly affect the valuations of the teams. But if we assume that the growth of the sport continues, which I think we all hope and expect it to, then I think we could see these valuations going up, maybe even 50% more than they are now.
Exactly. Yeah, we might see the first $10 billion Formula One team. I don't think that'll happen in 2026, but I do think we'll see it over the next 2 to 3 years, because it's also driven a lot by all the commercial revenues coming into the sport and new races coming on the calendar and all the rest of it. So the teams are sharing about $1.2 billion of F1's commercial revenues between them. And then on top of that, they've obviously got things like sponsorship revenue generated, and also in the case of teams like Mercedes, is they're making money from selling engines as well, which is how they get up to revenues of well over $600 million a year. So really incredible, well beyond a lot of top football teams. And then finally, what about F1's share price, Ronald? Liberty Media's not noticed by a lot of people, perhaps, but over Christmas, Chase Carey sold some of his F1 stock for raised $16 million, with a share price at around $95 a share. It started out in 2025 at $92, and it went as high as 108 and as low as 78. So what do we think it'll be 12 months from now, Ronald?
Well, I don't want to be pessimistic at all, but my first wish would be to have it on the same level. And that relates to the second part of Dan's answer, because for me, the big question mark is what the 2026 regulations will bring. And I think that's crucial for F1 as a whole. I remember in Vegas, I had a conversation with Ford's Mark Rushbrook, and we talked about the event and how F1 came alive again in the United States. And he said, yeah, what a place to go racing. And then we agreed that, yeah, it's phenomenal. But you can bring in new people via Drive to Survive, via the F1 movie. But in the end, you need one thing, and that's a good product. And ultimately, that means good racing. And the last couple of years, even though dirty air was a massive issue, even though overtaking was really and getting more and more difficult all the time, still the overall product was really good. And the racing itself was just exciting. We had a close field. And of course, we will have more field spread in 26. That's completely normal with new regulations. But my main wish is just that F1 will remain F1 as we know it, and that the racing itself will be good, that it will not be too complicated for the people at home, because the risk is a little bit there, I feel. Also, that it will not be too much of an energy-saving management, because I think that's not what the people want to see. So I really hope that the 2026 regulations play out as intended by the FIA. If they do, then most likely the number will grow. But for me, everything depends on how good the 2026 regulations will be on track. And let's say 1 or 2 years ago, when I first heard about all the plans, I was a little bit more pessimistic than I am now. So hopefully I will be fully convinced at the end of 26. But yeah, that for me is still the main question mark.
I think the other thing that's important is that they finally got all the Concord agreements sorted out. The commercial piece had been done in the spring with the teams and F1, but the governance agreement with the FIA only really came together just before Christmas. So now that that's in place for the next 5 years, that's a very stable platform for the sport to build on going forwards. And theoretically, at least everybody, all three stakeholders are all pointing in the same direction. So that is definitely a positive for growth. So if you're a stock picker and you're looking for a share to buy in 2026, then judge for yourself whether or not that means that you think the F1 stock will go up. But that's our analysis of it. That's it for the super forecasting. One final note, though, before we go. The FIA has confirmed the driver numbers for the 2026 season. There are a few points to note. Lando Norris is taking the number one plate, as is his right as world champion. Always like to see that. Max Verstappen, interestingly, the former champion, is not reverting to his old number 33. Instead, he's taken his old teammate Dan Ricciardo's number 3. Ronald, has he told you why he's done that?
Yeah, actually, he's given a lengthy analysis already in Vegas. He said, yeah, 3 has always been my favorite number just because I like the shape of it. And then he analyzed why he likes the shape. And then that media session got completely out of hand because then he was joking and said, well, the other alternative might be I go for number 69. And we said, 69? And he said, yeah, because sadly, I don't have any experience with 69 as a racing driver. And on that note, we left the whole numbers conversation. But he made pretty clear that he wanted to pick 3. It was already his first choice when he came into F1. But of course, that was not possible because Daniel Ricciardo held the number. The FIA changed the regulations now, so you can actually change the number. Also, Daniel Rick was positive about that with a letter. So yeah, he now got the number that he always wanted, of course, besides number one. But yeah, this was always his first choice, basically.
New boy Arvid Lindblad at Racing Bulls has chosen number 41. And the two veterans returning with Cadillac that we mentioned earlier on, they are retaining their numbers from before. Checo Perez will be number 11 and Valtteri Bottas is 77. If you want to know all the numbers, you can find them online. But that will do us for now. My thanks to Ronald Vording and to Dan Fallows. You can read Ronald's insightful F1 work on Autosport and Motorsport. And where can people catch up with you, Dan?
I've got yet to do a little bit more on it, but I have a Substack, which I'm updating, and also I have an article on a website called Race Tech, TEQ.
Very good, very good. So look out for that. Watch out also for the upcoming Autosport Business Exchange event on the morning of the 21st of January. Some great speakers lined up there, and there'll be full coverage of it on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. And that night is the 38th Autosport Awards. Many of the top names from Formula One and other series will be in London for the Oscars of Motorsport. Ross Brawn will be honoured with the Autosport Gold Medal for leaving a lasting legacy on the sport. And there's a star-studded presenting party for that. That's the 21st of January. Full coverage of the event on Autosport and Motorsport channels. My thanks to producer Ben, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We will be back with another podcast very soon.